Well, we're going to talk about history today, and it's actually a very timely topic. As you know, San Francisco is currently celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Great Earthquake. There's actually another anniversary going on, though, which you might not have seen so much about, although I will be putting out a press release about it next week, the 100th anniversary of drug prohibition and of the drug war. I'll explain that in a second, but it's interesting to remember, you know, when San Francisco burned, there was still no such thing as an illegal drug in this country. The way I always think of it, it's in my own grandparents' youth. It was possible for them to go into drug stores and buy any drug pretty much over the counter. Heroin was available, morphine, opiates, cocaine, chloral hydrate, and cannabis was there too. But this changed. And there was the first change at the federal level, the signal change, was when Congress itself, on May 7th, 1906, passed a model bill called the District of Columbia Pharmacy and Poisons Act. Everybody's forgotten about this bill, but it actually started the war on drugs in the District of Columbia. What this bill did was it said, from now on, it's going to be illegal to sell drugs, narcotics, by which they meant opium, cocaine, and chloral, over-the-counter to drug fiends. You can only sell them for valid medical purposes and not just for addiction, okay? And then they went on and they started to enforce it as well. They started sending in agents to the drug stores to make sure that none of the drug stores were selling cocaine without a prescription and so forth. And that was the beginning of the war on drugs. It was in the District of Columbia, because at that time, no one thought, no one imagined that Congress had the power to regulate drug use or drug sales in the states. But it was considered a model bill for the states to follow. It was quickly followed up by next year by California, numerous other states, and half the states already had a war on drugs going before the famous Harrison Act in 1914, which became the first federal anti-narcotics law for the entire country. Now, cannabis was not actually in the 1906 D.C. Act, but it got included soon in some of the state laws, and I'm going to talk about that later. There was, however, another law in 1906, passed in June of 1906, that did mention cannabis, and that's the famous Pure Food and Drugs Act. And that act had a labeling provision for drugs, saying any medicines that contained certain intoxicating narcotics, including opium and alcohol and cannabis, indica was one of them, had to state the contents on the label. Before that, you could just put anything in a bottle and call it, you know, Dr. Quack's Cure, and that was fine. But you had... cannabis was one of the things that had to be specified on the label, recognizing at the time, in fact, that cannabis was a medicine in 1906. Of course, now the same act, the Food and Drug Administration's powers have been vastly expanded, and now, of course, the current Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is used as an excuse for saying that marijuana is not a drug at all. So it's very interesting the way history changes things around and turns them on our head, on their head, and it's useful to remember how different things used to be, and it gives one hope how maybe things might be different again when we get into the new century. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the origins of cannabis prohibition later on, but we're going to proceed historically now with some experts here on some of the more obscure and forgotten and memorable landmarks in the history of cannabis. And starting out here with none other than Dr. Dope himself, Michael Aldrich, who got his Ph.D. in this, one of the first people to get his Ph.D. in actually studying drugs and narcotics, and who has been, I think, collecting items of historical memorabilia since the beginning of the movement. So, Michael, you're going to talk to us about W.B. O'Shaughnessy.
younger. I want to dedicate this talk to Dr. Todd McCaria, who first turned me on to WB O'Shaughnessy more than 30 years ago and changed my life. Better? How's that, Fred? Fred, can you hear that? Can you hear that back there better? And also to Fred Gardner, who got me off my ass. For 20 years ago, I did a huge study for a year and a half in Todd's living room, going through all of his papers about W.B. O'Shaughnessy and writing to the India Telegraph office and writing to the British East India Museums and all these London libraries and so forth, trying to flesh out, get some more information about W.B. And there it sat for, gosh, almost 20 years now. Until Fred Gardner said, we really need an article for O'Shaughnessy's magazine to say, who was W.B. O'Shaughnessy? Because, okay, who has heard of W.B. O'Shaughnessy? Very good. All right. Who knows that W.B. O'Shaughnessy was the first Westerner to introduce cannabis into Western medicine in 1839? See, even better. Todd, you did a great job. The reason that you know that is because Todd put W.B. O'Shaughnessy's article in his book, Marijuana Medical Papers, as the lead article, and reintroduced O'Shaughnessy to a whole new generation, not only of activists, but of doctors. And that has been extremely important in my life, and I'm sure in the lives of all medical marijuana patients to this day. Now, who in this audience knows anything else that W.B. O'Shaughnessy did? Well, okay, my wife, Dave Berriman, Vince, a few, Donnie, good. All right, I'm going to tell you a story about a fabulous Irishman. I'm going to go pretty fast. This was the first picture that Todd ever found. It was from the National Library of Medicine. It shows this young Irish guy in India in the early 1830s working on his chemistry bench. And the reason that W.B. O'Shaughnessy is famous in the history of medicine is not just for the introduction of cannabis into Western medicine, but because he discovered the modern cure for cholera. The treatment that is still used for cholera throughout the world today was discovered by this guy when he was 20 years old. Amazing situation. W.B. O'Shaughnessy was born into a lower middle class Irish family in 1809, although his baptismal certificate says November 1808, and we can't figure out how to get baptized before he got born. So Todd is of the opinion that he was probably really born in 1808, right? He was very bright. We don't know much about his youth. His father was a merchant. He was very bright, enough to get into the world's best school in 1827, graduated in 2 years. So he's 20 years old when he graduates from the best medical school. I don't know how many doctors are here, but I don't think you graduated from medical school at the age of 20. Maybe you're going into medical school if you're real bright. At Edinburgh, he studied with two very famous professors. One was Sir Robert Christison, who wrote the best 19th century book on poisons, and who practically invented the science of forensic toxicology. I'll talk about that in a minute. By doing chemical investigations of poisons and of the blood of victims of poisons, which was his main forte. Christison was also a huge scholar on cannabis, but that was after his student O'Shaughnessy introduced him to the idea. The other professor that was very famous at Edinburgh at the time was Sir Robert Knox, Professor Robert Knox. And the reason he's famous is because he was all involved in a huge trial of the century in England involving two grave robbers named Burke and Hare, who started out by taking cadavers out of graves, bringing them back to the Edinburgh Medical School so the students would have something to dissect, which was totally against the law, of course. Robert Knox became very famous because he defended this practice in the light of the fact that it was educating medical students into the realities of the human body. It was totally illegal at the time. But however, Burke and Hare then went on to start killing people and before the, to contribute their bodies, and that didn't make it. Even Christison had to testify against Burke for allowing that to happen in his laboratory. The result, however, was for the first generation of British doctors to be really well trained in anatomy, in knowing how and where things were in the human body. In 1929, he graduated from Edinburgh, very young age. He taught chemistry students, tutored them, so how they could get through Christus's and Burke's courses. Moved to London in 1830 and couldn't get a job. He couldn't get a license to practice medicine, even though he's very bright, because the doctors of London had a closed shop. Unless you were the son or daughter of a London doctor, you couldn't get a license to practice medicine in London, except unless you paid £10,000 sterling. And, of course, for a graduate from medical school, we know what that's about. So he couldn't literally get a license. So he was in need of work. He needed a job. So he invented his own CSI lab. He'd studied with the best forensic toxicologist in the world, Robert Christison. He sets up what amounted to a CSI lab. He analyzed blood, feces, urine, and bodily fluids of any type for the courts, for doctors, and for legal cases. In fact, some of his work was used in the Burke and Hare trial. So that's a very good concept. I mean, you need work, set up your own CSI lab. This is 100 years before CSI labs were very common in the world. He started doing all these blood analyses of various victims of diseases, trying to figure out what the chemistry of the disease itself was, the very early pioneering effort here. In 1830s, the cholera epidemic broke out in London, which was very severe. They didn't know what caused cholera. It turned out 80 years later that it was caused by a Vibrio. It's called Vibrio cholerae. But that wasn't even known at the time. All that was known was that people who got cholera thought to be people who had some connection with anybody who had returned from India. It was sort of like the beginning of the AIDS epidemic where everybody had to be in certain groups or you couldn't get it, right? He started analyzing the blood of cholera victims. And in 1831, he wrote, I'll give this quote. He wrote what a modern historian in Ireland has called one of the shortest and yet most significant letters ever sent to the journal, The Lancet. This was in the first 2 years of The Lancet, the British medical journal. And O'Shaughnessy simply sent them a very short letter saying, I've analyzed the blood of many cholera victims. It looks to me like they are suffering from acidosis, which means too much acid, lack of alkalinity, the same thing, and lack of electrolytically balanced proper fluids. The reason that cholera kills people is because you shit out of every end. You shit and vomit, and you shit and vomit, and you shit and vomit, and you die. You become so dehydrated. I only have 5 minutes? Oh, I haven't even gotten to dope yet. All right, in 1831, he sent a letter to The Lancet discovering the modern treatment for cholera, which is the intravenous injection of electrolytically balanced fluids. It's exactly the same principle as modern athletes drinking Gatorade. It prevents dehydration from killing you, you know? It immediately replaces the fluids with a proper electrolytic balance that your body needs. Published this, it was mind-bending because nobody knew what caused cholera. It was the 19th century equivalent of finding a cure for AIDS without knowing what HIV was. Amazing stunt. Kid's 21 years old. So he publishes this. The head of the cholera commission in London, it comes to the attention of this guy who had returned from India to head the cholera commission. He gives O'Shaughnessy, this poor Irish kid, a plum assignment. He assigns him as an assistant surgeon in the British East India Company. Now, that's a plum assignment for British aristocrats. O'Shaughnessy goes over there in 1833, becomes professor of materia medica at the Calcutta Medical College that he helped to found. He starts learning Indian languages and some Middle Eastern languages. He talks with Ayurvedic physicians and Islamic physicians in India. And in 1839, he calls a little meeting of what was just a little college study group. It was called the Surgical and Physical Society, Medical and Physical Society of Calcutta. It was about 40 people, including some of his local sources who were the Ayurvedic doctors. Delivers a 40-page paper which changed our lives, all about the medicinal use of cannabis. He did the first clinical trials on cannabis ever in the world, first on animals to establish safety, secondly on human beings suffering from, let's get it exactly right, rheumatism, hydrophobia, cholera, tetanus, and convulsions. He immediately, within 2 days, cured a 40-day-old baby who had convulsions and was about to die, and he gave her a tincture of cannabis. He invented his own tinctures in India. That's what I feature him doing here. And we can go to the next slide. Yes. Oh, very good. Todd hated this picture when we made this picture out of his hero. A hippie artist in the 60s decorated it with a marijuana leaf on W.B. O'Shaughnessy's bench. And the truth of that picture is simply that he was the first to invent cannabis tinctures that are now commonly used in medical practice. So he published this little paper and got sick himself. He had published three other books at the same time in India, including the first Bengal dispensary and the first Bengal pharmacopoeia, and one of the first biochemistry books in the world, which was called A Manual of Chemistry. He wrote them in English for his Indian students, very early examples of imperialist education that worked. And the reason it worked is because India has 360 different languages, and if you can find out Indian medical lore in English, that means that anybody can learn English. So it's a great example of early education in the science fields. He went back to England and took with him quantities of hemp for the Pharmaceutical Society and specimens of cannabis indica, which were the first specimens they had for the Royal Botanical Gardens at Kew. This brought him attention to the Royal Society, which is the main scientific organization at the time in England. He was made a fellow of the Royal Society in 1843, sailed back to India, and completely changed careers. A most amazing event. He had just turned on the Western world. All the chemists in England and Europe and America were vying with each other to make good tinctures. And that continued until 1964. Goes back to India, changes careers, becomes the assistant assayist for the mint, inventing coinage that was standard throughout India instead of the hundreds of different currency systems they had in India at the time. In 1848, a man named Lord Dalhousie became the Governor General of India, and that really helped O'Shaughnessy because Dalhousie is the man who's remembered for the infrastructure of India. He built the railroads, the telegraph, the public education system, the postage system, and so forth. O'Shaughnessy proposed the idea of building a telegraph throughout India at a time when the longest telegraph in England was 18 miles long. So 18 miles long. So O'Shaughnessy wants to build a 3,000-mile telegraph in India, full of electrical storms, full of all these disadvantages of having to cross rivers and swamps and bays and wild jungles and so forth. Convinces Dalhousie that this is possible, although it's obviously patently impossible to build a telegraph in India in the 1850s. He strings an experimental line between the port harbor city of Calcutta across the River Hooghly into Calcutta itself. It's longer than the longest telegraph line in England at 27 miles, and it works. It was the first underwater telegraphy in the world. Then he got Dalhousie to get him some funding from the British East India Company, help from 60 officers and about 150 Indian men to string telegraph as fast as he could across India. By 1854, he had completed 3,050 miles of telegraph running from Calcutta. Oh, maybe the map of India? Yeah. Running from Calcutta on the upper right across to Agra, which is just below Delhi, all the way down to Bombay on that side, and then across the continent to Madras. In doing so, he and Dalhousie constructed the world's biggest telegraph. This is only 4 years after Samuel F.B. Morse strung 15 miles in Washington, D.C. This is across India, the first really major telegraph system in the world. For that event, O'Shaughnessy was knighted by Queen Victoria in 1856 and is remembered forever for those three events: the invention of the modern treatment for cholera, the introduction of cannabis to Western medicine, and the amazing feat of establishing 4,000 miles of telegraph in India in the 1850s. Thank you.